This is special coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This hour, the holy month of Ramadan is coming, but the U.S.-led war on terrorism isn't taking a break. We examine the price and precedent for bombing during Ramadan. First, another member of the International Coalition Against Terrorism gears up for ground war in Afghanistan. British Armed Forces Minister Adam Ingram told Parliament today that Royal Marine Commandos, based on the assault ship Fearless, were ready for immediate deployment. Earlier, I spoke with Major Charles Heyman, editor of Jane's World Armies. He says Britain has made a significant commitment.
First of all, Britain's role so far has been restricted to using firing cruise missiles from submarines and also from providing tanker aircraft over Afghanistan to tank some of the Navy fighters onto their targets, and an awful lot of photographic reconnaissance. Now, what Britain's doing from here on is it's providing quite a large number of what we describe as special forces. And we think that in the short term now, they're going to operate in parallel with US troops. And they're almost certainly going to start raiding into Afghanistan, going after Al-Qaeda targets and Taliban targets that intelligence has identified as being targets of high value and worth targets that are worth risking lives to destroy.
So you'd say this is a substantial, not a symbolic deployment?
Oh, it's substantial. However, the Chief of Defence Staff, the UK Chief of Defence Staff, said today that a lot more troops would be available from the UK and that the forces actually off the coast of Pakistan could be very, very rapidly reinforced, easily within 12 hours and with large numbers within 24 hours.
Tony Blair has been very clear with his support of the U.S. effort, but what is the level of public support in the United Kingdom for British troops on the ground in Afghanistan?
Probably about a quarter of the population asking some very, very difficult questions, but the mass of the population are on side. One of the problems, though, are the scenes of civilian casualties that are coming out of Afghanistan now. I know that those scenes have already had an impact in the U.S., and they're having a similar impact in the U.K., and they're also having a major impact in the Middle East and in South Asia.
How do you think the military effort is going overall?
I think it's been going to plan up to a very few days ago. I think that the raid by the Rangers on Friday night encountered more opposition than was expected. And I think that to a certain extent, has almost put the Taliban's tails up. And the Taliban appear more confident at the moment than they probably should do. And I think that's now having an impact on the planners in both the Pentagon and the UK MOD.
In what direction? What sort of impact?
Well, I think the impact is that they were hoping that there would be a quick fix, and certainly the politicians were hoping that there would be a quick fix. Mm-hmm. After a few days of bombing, the Taliban would roll over, maybe like Milosevic did at the end of the air campaign, and say, we've had enough, what do you want? The signs now are that is not going to happen. And as the Chief of the Defence Staff said about 10 days ago, this campaign could go all the way through the winter, into the spring, and possibly into the summer.
So certainly through Ramadan, which is coming right up.
And that's yet another problem. Operations during Ramadan will have an impact on popular opinion in the Middle East and South Asia, and some of the governments in that area may find it difficult to hold the ring, especially when their population really start to make some very loud noises.
Charles Heyman, why haven't other nations joined in militarily? Is this invitation only? The United States and the UK don't want other nations involved, or is there some other kind of resistance or reluctance?
Well, I mean, I must say that we have actually got the Australians on board as well. They're sending their SAS almost lock, stock and barrel. We've got the Canadians with Joint Task Force 2, and we may have some French and we may have some Germans farther down the line. But I think one of the reasons that a lot of people haven't joined in is that they don't have the military with the offensive capability that you need for these operations. I mean, the world is full of soldiers who are dressed up in combat gear and steel helmets. But when it comes to a fight, they are virtually useless.
So now there are a few, and certainly the UK and US, who are there. What will victory look like?
Unfortunately, it's not going to be, I don't think, a big victory with a big victory parade, and it's not going to be like a Gulf War.
Not even in the Afghanistan operation specifically?
It's probable that the Afghanistan campaign will just wind down. And at the end of the day, we'll be able to say, well, the Taliban have been punished for supporting terrorism. And we go on to phase two, where we look at other countries and we say, if you don't eliminate the terrorists from your soil, we will come and do it for you. And look what happened to Afghanistan.
Are you suggesting that punishment of the Taliban might not include their removal from power?
I think that at the end of the day, any government that is in Afghanistan in the long term will probably have a moderate element of the Taliban in it. I think it's you can remove the hardline Taliban from power, but the Taliban is a number of factions as well, and there is a moderate element there which is probably dismayed and appalled at what is going on. And they will almost certainly have to have some representation in a future Afghan government. And I can't see a way around that. Any future Afghan government is going to have to take in representatives of all the factions in Afghanistan. And that's the only way we're going to get any sort of stability there. One thing I know for certain is that the British and the US should not try and stay in Afghanistan long term and support an unpopular government, because that's what happened to the Russians in the 1980s. And the same could happen to us in the long term if we're not careful.
Major Charles Hayman is editor of Jane's World Armies. I spoke to him earlier today from London. The word Ramadan comes from an Arabic root meaning scorching heat. The holy month starting mid-November is meant to focus the believer in a crucible of fasting and prayer. There is no explicit prohibition against fighting during Ramadan, but there is pressure coming from America's allies and enemies to call a timeout in the Afghan military campaign. U.S. leaders say they must fight on. Could that strategy cost America the Islamic wing of its international coalition? Joining us now is Imam Talib Abdul Rashid. He's the Imam of the Mosque of the Islamic Brotherhood in Harlem. Good evening, Imam Talib Abdul Rashid.
Yes, good evening.
Thank you for joining us. And from the studios of Vermont Public Radio is our special coverage news analyst, Jack Beatty, senior editor of the Atlantic Monthly Magazine. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom.
You can join the conversation as well. We're at 1-800-423-TALK, 1-800-423-8255. Imam, if you'd be kind enough to help us, first of all, just understand the basics of Ramadan. What exactly does this month observe in the Islamic tradition? And what are the peculiar or particular sensitivities of Muslims during this time?
Yes, I'm sorry. Let me just correct you first. That's
Please.
The Mosque of Islamic Brotherhood. It's not the Islamic Brotherhood. That's in Egypt.
My apologies.
It's quite all right. Ramadan is one of the primary acts of worship, disciplines of worship that is observed by Muslims globally. There are certain fundamental religious practices that all Muslims adhere to. Ramadan actually is the name of the ninth month of the Islamic calendar. And traditionally, it is a time wherein those Muslims who are not prohibited from doing so for medical reasons abstain from food and drink from before sun up until sundown for a 29 to 30-day period. It's a time of particular reverence for us, a time of particular heightening of spiritual practice, and therefore it's a very sacred time of the year for us.
What exactly does it observe? We understand it's the period where the Prophet Muhammad is to have received the Quran. Is that correct?
Actually, it's the time when the revelation of the Quran to the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, started. The fasting during the month of Ramadan is actually the basis for it. It's found in the Quran, and there's a statement in the Quran to that effect, that Ramadan is the month in which the revelation of the Quran began. And so we commemorate that month or that period of time by, as I said, by fasting, There are also special prayers that are made during the month of Ramadan. The Muslims read 1/30 of the Quran every day during the month of Ramadan, so that by the end of the month, we've read the entire book from cover to cover and that sort of thing.
So it's a period of greater intensity in religious focus and concentration, and fasting all day, I guess, keeps it foremost in everyone's mind. Is there greater than usual attendance at the mosque during that time, more frequent, or is it still the Friday prayers that mark Ramadan?
Yes, the attendance at the mosques always increases during the month of Ramadan. You know, Muslims are like other people of faith. Mm-hmm. That is to say, you know, we have varying degrees of practice. Mm-hmm. So just as in Christianity, there are certain times of the year when the churches are filled to overflowing. Mm-hmm. In Judaism, the same thing in the synagogue, and so it is sure. with Muslims in the mosque. Muslims who, even in some cases, haven't been particularly observant during the rest of the year, they all kind of flock to the mosque and reconcentrate their spiritual energies during that month. And also, as I said, there are extra prayers nightly, in addition to the five regular prayers that we make during the day and night all year round.
In Christian and Jewish holidays and others, we understand there's often an envelope of particular kind of sentiment that's traditionally around different holidays.
Yes.
Is there an atmosphere or a kind of sentiment, social sentiment, even outside the strict bounds of religion that tends to accompany Ramadan?
Yes, I would say so. Within the religio-spiritual dimension, the key word I would say is reverence. Outside of that, the social dimension would be joy.
Now, why is that? People are fasting.
Well, yes, but believe me, when you've been fasting all day and when the sun comes down, there is joy in the land, if you know what I mean.
Yes.
You're grateful even for a glass of water, the things that we take for granted all year round.
And I've read that there's a very active social life during this time.
Well, yes. Again, each night is like a little celebration, a little feast. When the sun goes down until time for the evening prayers. So we have this moment that's called iftar, which is the breaking of the fast. And that's a very joyous time. And then at the end of the month, when the sacred month is over, we have a big holy day observation that lasts anywhere from 3 up until, in some countries, 10 days. That's probably our most joyous celebration of the year.
Jack Beatty, it doesn't sound like a time that anyone would want to throw a bomb into, and yet circumstances are leading to military action going on right in the middle of this.
Yeah, just what the Imam was saying, a period of heightened spiritual practice, reverence, holiest time of the year. No, it couldn't be a worse time for bombs. You know, I think we have to ask ourselves when we hear these sorts of things, the end of our campaign is not just to kill bin Laden. It is to make Americans safe against fear. And the question is, if we continue this campaign into this holy season, will we in fact increase our security or weaken it? And I think that as you hear these words about how holy the time is, I think our planners have really got to take this kind of thing into account and balance the tactical situation against the overall strategic mission, which is not to create more terrorism, which is not to turn this into a war of the West against the rest, but to make Americans safe from the fear of terrorism.
Absolutely.
We're going to be exploring this further. Imam Talib Abdul Rashid, thank you very much for joining us for this section of our show.
You're welcome.
Imam Talib Abdul Rashid is Imam of the Mosque of Islamic Brotherhood in Harlem. We're talking about the imminent arrival with the new moon in November of Ramadan and the intersection, unfortunately, of that great Muslim holiday with the Western military campaign, the U.S.-led coalition against terrorism campaign that Washington says will go on, if need be, right through. What are the implications of that? We'll be looking closely after this break. You can join us at 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to special coverage from WBUR Boston. This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking this evening about Ramadan. It's coming up in less than 3 weeks, the holiest month of the Islamic calendar, when Muslims fast during all daylight hours and pay special attention to prayer and religious renewal. What are the implications during this holy time of year of the ongoing military campaign in Afghanistan against terror and the Taliban? Is it worth keeping up the bombing if we risk galvanizing further Islamic public opinion against the campaign? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined by our special coverage news analyst, Jack Beatty, and joining us now, Ibrahim Musa, a professor of religion at Duke University. Welcome, Ibrahim Musa.
Hello, Tom.
Thank you very much for joining us this evening.
Thank you.
Ibrahim Musa is co-director of the Center for the Study of Muslim Networks at Duke. He's author of the forthcoming book, Rethinking Islam in Postmodernity. Ibrahim Musa, help us put this in some kind of context. U.S. officials are saying that they prefer to have this all wrapped up, but it's not going that quickly. And if they must fight during Ramadan, that they will fight during Ramadan. There's a lot to look at here, but first of all, help us look simply at history. Have Muslims fought during Ramadan?
Oh, yes. There's no prohibition in Islamic law for people to, for Muslims not to fight. In the past, Muslims have fought during Ramadan, and as recently in the Middle East conflict between Egypt and Israel, there was a war waged in the month of Ramadan. The only kind of restriction there would be is that if there is a war in the holy sanctuaries, there are certain months, part of the Arabic months, in which Muslims cannot engage in a kind of offensive war in the holy sanctuary, that is in Mecca and the holy places.
Mm-hmm. So there's a precedent and no prohibition on war during this time. But what about, I mean, in this case, the coalition is being tarred as, is being portrayed as the infidel. Does it make a difference that this is a U.S.-led coalition that may be pursuing war during this month?
Well, I think that does add to part of the problem. It is U.S.-led. Some people would see the United States as not being part, you know, I mean, the term infidel, you used it. And some people in the Muslim world would term and call the U.S. And the people in the United States to be infidels. I think three things, or at least two, needs to be understood. Mm-hmm. One is the whole question about how religion and politics is viewed in a particular culture and how it might be different in another. And secondly, what kind of sentiment does Ramadan distribute amongst adherents? Let me address the first question, and that is, normally Americans recoil in horror when they see religious leaders and religious figures making political speeches, because in this country there has been a separation between religion and state, or religion and church and state. But we must remember that this is a fairly recent phenomenon in modern history, because before the Enlightenment, the European Enlightenment, religious phenomena were always seen as part and parcel of a political, social, and cultural forms. And so the separation from politics and public life is founded on a secular Enlightenment approach. Mm-hmm. This kind of approach does not prevail in Muslim countries. Even though you find countries like Egypt and Pakistan to be secular in some respects, the door between politics and religion is a revolving door. Mm-hmm. And therefore, politicians are very, very much aware about what the religious sector says. And the religious sectors would very often also make speeches and make intervention in the way government is conducting itself.
The United States finds itself running into this fact again and again right now in the broader context of this conflict. Is this fact even more intense during the month of Ramadan, and what risks does that carry for the U.S.?
Oh, yes. I think that, you know, it depends how it plays out, but, you know, one can begin to explore the possibilities of risk. Imagine in the month of Ramadan is, as the Imam has said, that it's a time of deep, intense prayer and meditation. But the one of the important sentiments that is generated in the month of Ramadan as people hunger during the daylight hours is a concern for the poor and the oppressed and those who have been deprived. And it is a time for solidarity with those who are oppressed and those who are suffering.
And
okay?
This year,
and you'll see all those pictures on television of Afghan refugees enduring a humanitarian catastrophe and humanitarian disaster and the bombs raining down. You do the math and see when millions of people see this on CNN, on Al Jazeera, and other television screens, what the Muslim reaction would be.
Jack Beatty, if you're the U.S. government, what are you thinking? What do we do?
Well, you know, everyone is talking about the balancing act here. On the one hand, if we don't continue with our campaign, we essentially allow the enemy, defined as the Taliban and Al-Qaeda, to reposition and refit themselves and prepare and essentially prolongs the war. On the other hand, the risk of creating those pictures is a serious one. I mean, it's as if there's the tactical imperative to get this campaign through, or at least to some kind of resolution before winter closes it off. On the one hand, and on the other hand, the political and strategic and propaganda, and I don't say that slightingly, imperative to minimize the sort of psychic collateral damage. And this is a time, this is an extremely difficult business. And, you know, I must say this had to have been part of bin Laden's plan all along.
It almost seems the timing. He knew that we'd be going right into this period.
Just to create one of these hurdles after another to try to provoke what he wants, which is the clash of civilizations, which is more of what we see in Pakistan, where young men from these madrasas are reportedly going across the border to fight for the Taliban. He wants that all over the world.
We don't want to ascribe too much genius here, but there's September 11th and 6 weeks, 8 weeks, 10 weeks later, boom, Ramadan.
Yes.
Yeah. We have listeners who want to join the conversation. Let us bring a couple in. We're looking at the impending onset of the Islamic holy month of Ramadan and the ongoing bombing in Afghanistan. Is military action during Ramadan worth the potential price in offending the Islamic world? Do we have a choice? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Nikki is on the line. Hi, Nikki.
Hi. I can't really comment on, let's say, the military drawbacks of ceasing our pressure during Ramadan, but I think that it's pretty obvious what the political and sort of public relations, et cetera, ramifications will be. And I think it's really monumentally stupid. I think it's going to be really counterproductive. It's going to be one of those that proves it moments. I think a lot of people who have been willing to give the U.S. the benefit of the doubt, you know, a lot of Muslims seeing and even non-Muslims who might be willing to give the U.S. the benefit of the doubt at this moment will, you know, be convinced by the end of the month that, you know, it is another of our wars of cultural imperialism, even if it's not, you know.
But, Nikki, what if it means that the Taliban has an entire month to regroup, that Osama bin Laden has an entire month to escape, and that it makes United States citizens and perhaps others more vulnerable? How do you handle that calculus?
Look, I haven't figured out, you know, what to. I mean, the thing is that I'm not convinced that we will make U.S. citizens safer by continuing during that period, because just think how much worse it's going to be for King Abdullah or for the Saudis or for the Egyptian government. I mean, this is going to be, it's not going to be like a minor bit of complaining that's going to go on in those very sort of teetery sort of nations.
Nikki, you make a good point, and it's exactly the problem. Ibrahim Musa, what about it? What kind of message do you expect Muslims in the Middle East may hear from the mosques during this month of Ramadan if the attacks are going on?
Well, first of all, it's a month where people get together for prayers, and there's a lot of mobilization that can take place. At night, people, there'll be long speeches. And imagine that most of those people will be understanding, whereas people in the United States might think they're fighting a just cause. On the other hand, those very fasting Muslims are believing that they are fighting a just cause, and they are, and this war in Afghanistan is an unjust one. And so there'll be two very different perspectives. So the rhetoric of injustice, the rhetoric of American imperialism, the rhetoric of barbarity and causing more suffering, I mean, that's just going to come out in huge amounts of outpouring in various places. Now, you might say that the public relations war is already lost. And that's what, you know, is already happening in different places.
Well, now there's a thought. Can we win if that war is lost?
The question is that how many more losses are you prepared to take? In other words, if this campaign intensifies and the opposition intensifies in places like Pakistan and Egypt and other places, is the United States prepared to take the losses of its allies who will then drop off one by one, or will completely capitulate, or a country like Pakistan that's a part of the front line of the coalition, that the possibility of a coup d'etat of more religious elements within the Musharraf regime can overthrow Musharraf.
Jack Beattie, Ibrahim Musa is a professor of religion at Duke University, but as he points out, religion and politics sit side by side in much of the Muslim world, and he's telling us the PR battle's already lost.
Yeah, that's pretty grim. I wonder, I have a question for him. Recently, some Egyptian scholars, Quranic scholars, came out and said that terrorism itself should be the object of a jihad. And they had impeccably anti-Western credentials. They weren't people who were, you know, could be say they were co-opted by the British or the Americans. And they were saying it is terrorism that should be the object of a jihad, not the war on terrorism. Is there any chance that their sort of version of this will get into these mosques, that people will hear that version from within the faith itself?
Jack, you're absolutely right. Just a slight, my recollection is that this was said by Ayatollah Khamenei, who is the spiritual leader of Iran, not the best friend of the United States at the moment. And he said that...
We're not the worst.
and he said that there should be a jihad against terrorism. The Iranians understand that well. The Iranian deputy foreign minister came to the United Nations, spoke there, and they said if this was a campaign that was done under the auspices of the United Nations and international organizations, Iran would have joined there. Most people in the Muslim world thought, and on the 12th of September, the United States had the sympathy of the entire world. People were grieving in many parts of the world, including the Muslim world, at the loss and the tragedy, and were completely outraged. But I think where a great opportunity was lost is to turn this into a policing operation where there could have been, it would have been, take much more longer time, it would require a longer haul, much more negotiation, but the possibility of striking at the heart of terrorism could have been accomplished. Now the United States has been turned into a villain in the Muslim world because it is just seen as overkill on a country, and where you're pouring rubble upon rubble.
Ibrahim Musa, Jack Beattie, our callers want to join the conversation. We've got to let them. We're at 1-800-423-8255. We welcome them. Julian is on the line. Welcome, Julian.
Hi. I just have a question. I guess it's for Professor Musa, but it's just for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just wondering why, when you mentioned a previous war in the Middle East that was fought during Ramadan, you neglected
and not only one, but any number of wars.
No, but he specifically referred to one.
Mm-hmm.
He just kind of neglected some of the specifics, which is that he was referring to the one in 1973, which has been called the Ramadan War, which was waged by Syria and Egypt, two Muslim nations, against a non-Muslim nation, Israel.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, what's the message here, that Muslim nations can wage a war during Ramadan, but they can't receive one? I mean, it's a coalition of Muslim nations that we're concerned will find this appropriate, right?
Right.
I mean, it seems an absurd dilemma for us.
We've got it. Julian, it's a sharp question. Ibrahim Musa, is it a fair one? And how would you answer?
No, I don't think I disagree with the caller. The question is that... That was a war waged against Israel. So there's no prohibition of Muslims engaging in a war, fighting back, etc. What the question that we are exploring today is not about the fact whether Muslims can engage in a war. We are exploring the question of what the public relations effect is going to be of this war, of people or millions of people who do not see this war in the same way as Julian and other people see this war. It's a perspectival thing, and it's a huge gulf in perspective.
Julian, how does that strike you?
I just think it's an absurd. This is, you know, this whole thing is a propaganda war against us, and we're accepting the wrong terms of the argument.
But what if we take losses in that propaganda war by being at war during Ramadan, right or wrong?
Well, I mean, the way to fight a propaganda war is to be honest in our own rhetoric and to point out the hypocrisy that's, you know, we're being held to this impossible standard that Muslims aren't holding themselves to.
Mm, Julian, thanks for your call. We got it. Thanks for your
Tom,
call. Yes.
The question is, I think that Julian's concern is asking the wrong question. It's not about the hypocrisy. I mean, I think hypocrisy can be found in Muslim countries as well. I mean, no one has a monopoly on hypocrisy.
Mm-hmm.
But the question here is that what is the effects of this war going to be on United States allies? I think that's a question you're asking. And whether this alliance will be able to hold up, that is a fundamental question.
Jack Beatty, how about that? We've seen, especially in Pakistan, President Pervez Musharraf repeatedly asking for us to hurry up and get out of Afghanistan.
Yes, and he specifically said, let's stop the visuals as soon as possible. And I'm wondering, just sort of inter alia here, whether this emphasis now on the British just sending in special ops and the whole turn to the ground campaign is not in some way a kind of response to that. Okay, we're not going to do you many more visuals here because we've eliminated pretty much all the targets that are there, all the targets that are not politically too sensitive to strike. But now we're going to turn to the special ops. We're going to do raids on the ground. We're not going to give you images to do show around the world. There aren't going to be bombing. There isn't going to be CNN. It's going to be a silent war.
Ibrahim Musa, I'm sorry, Jack.
Go ahead. But I'm just wondering if this isn't a sort of response to that.
Could well be. Ibrahim Musa, do you think that might be effective? If we take away those images of the bombs coming down and the buildings on fire, does that help?
Well, I mean, it will certainly help in terms of the visuals, and people will not know. But you must also remember that if CNN is not there, Al Jazeera is there. Al Jazeera television in Qatar, and it has rights to be in there. I think this is the first time. I mean, the reason why I think Muslim opinion has been as inflamed as it has been right now during the Gulf War, it was CNN that was right there in Baghdad and sending out pictures. On this occasion, you have an Arabic television station that is showing everything that is happening, and minutes after the bombs has fallen, its cameras are right there to show the effects of it.
And so, I suppose even if it's not bombing but a special ops raid that leads damage, the Al Jazeera cameras, or CNN for that matter, can be there.
That's right. And I think that it will be obviously a very different kind of war, this. And maybe, as this morning Thomas Friedman said in the New York Times, that this is a war that the United States will have to go alone and possibly with the Brits on its side.
Mm. Ibrahim Musa, thank you very much for joining us this evening.
You're welcome.
Ibrahim Musa is professor of religion at Duke University. He's co-director of the Center for Study of Muslim Networks at Duke. He's author of the forthcoming book, Rethinking Islam in Postmodernity. Coming up, the final installment in our Afghan literature series, followed by an end-of-the-week roundup with our special coverage news analyst, Jack Beatty. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. This is Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Coming up, a wrap-up of the week's news with our special coverage news analyst, Jack Beatty. First, the last installment of our series on the literature of Afghanistan and what it reveals about the character and culture of the Afghan people. For four nights, we've concentrated on 1,000 years of Afghan writers, but no one has shaped the Western perspective on the Central Asian nation more than one English writer, Rudyard Kipling.
Kabul town is sand and dust. Blow the bugle, draw the sword. I'd have sooner drowned it fast instead of him beside the ford. Ford, 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 a Kabul river. Ford, a Kabul river in the dark. You can hear the horses threshing. You can hear the men a-splashing across the ford of Kabul River in the dark.
In the 19th century, Britain and Russia battled for control of Central Asia. Kipling called it the Great Game, and the stories and poems he wrote about it, The Man Who Would Be King, Kim, and Barrack Room Ballads, depicted a country of tribal societies with savage fighters and even more savage terrain. How on target was Rudyard Kipling, an English writer from the age of empire? Joining us now from Brighton, England, is Michael Smith. He's vice president of the Kipling Society. Welcome, Michael Smith.
Thank you very much indeed, Tom.
You've spent a career looking at the work of Rudyard Kipling. He's probably the Westerner who's had the most to do with creating the Western images and ideas of South Asia, Central Asia, and Afghanistan.
That's perfectly true, although, in fact, he only spent just over 12 years of his lifetime in the Indian subcontinent, five as a small boy, and then seven as a working journalist, in which he made a tremendous reputation.
What was the basis of that reputation as a journalist?
Well, he's a craftsman with words. He has a real gift. He also, in his spare time, while he was a journalist on the Civil and Military Gazette, used to write stories and poems for his own enjoyment, because he was a very bad sleeper. And eventually, these were published by the Civil and Military Gazette in the paper, and then later collected, and once they were published as complete works, they really caught fire and caught the imagination of the Anglo-Indian who he was really introducing to themselves. And when he came back to England at the end of his 7 years hard, as he called it, he was a literary lion.
What's so astonishing today is how Kipling's work of decades and decades ago now still seems to frame this region. It lives in the minds of so many people. I know my own father always quoted Kipling. There's a grave by the Pangbang River, a grave that the Burmans shun, and there's Sabador Tuag Tawara. I remember hearing that as a child, and there's a magic about it. It worked. What is it that makes it so compelling? And I guess more importantly, is it an accurate and useful reflection of this region today?
Oh, I'm sure it is, although he was concentrating, when he was talking about Afghanistan, on the Afghan war that had been fought just before he came out. It was seared into his consciousness, and he was right. He wrote some of the stories about some of the activities that our troops had gone through and some of the terrible disasters which had befallen them when they were in Afghanistan. And as a reporter, he covered the arrival through the Khyber Pass of the Emir of Afghanistan, who the new viceroy, Lord Dufferin, was going to welcome in Peshawar, because we wanted to produce a buffer state between the Raj and the likely invasion coming from Russia.
So he was early on in introducing us to the Great Game, the contest for Central Asian power between the United Kingdom and Russia.
Absolutely, he was. In fact, it was the novel Kim which brought the term the Great Game into general use, although it had been coined in 1842 by Arthur Connolly, who had been beheaded by the Emir of Bukhara.
Michael Smith, as we opened this segment, we heard a passage from Ford or Kabul River, where Kipling writes about British soldiers in the dark, in battle, in danger, in Kabul. Can you give us a sense of that, and how well did Kipling portray the Afghanistan of his time?
Well, he certainly portrayed them very well, although he realized that they were incredibly good fighters and they fought a totally different kind of war to that which the British Army was used to fighting. And we have, I think, learned from that, and we tend now to fight more of a guerrilla war than we would have done in the past. But the Ford of Kabul River was the fact that two squadrons were, one of the 10th Hussars and one of the 11 Bengal Lancers, were ordered to ford the River Kabul and to get behind some enemy tribesmen. And in doing so, the Lancers crossed, but the last two of their donkeys were washed away. And by that time, the speed of the river and the encumbrances of their uniforms and of the packs they were carrying meant that the horses that they were riding slipped away off the ford into the water. And so 47 English soldiers were actually died as a result of that disaster.
So could you share with us a bit of how he described the Afghan? Do you have anything you could read that might give us a flavor for the character of the Afghan?
Yes, there are many lovely pieces in the dispatches that he sent back from Jamrud, the foot of the Khyber Pass. These are two of the chieftains of the Emir of Afghanistan arriving in the camp to discuss the arrangements for the reception of their master. Two of his sirdars arrived in camp this morning and are at present enjoying their midday meal. Neither Qazi Qutbuddin nor Aga Haider Shah were pleasant to look on as they squatted on their charpoys and asked all manner of questions regarding the arrangements of the camp. The Aga was clad in a camel's hair garment adorned with gold stripes, and his lower limbs were encased in what looked remarkably like European trousers. He was a short, thick-set, and of florid countenance, laughing and talking a good deal. The Qazi, who lounged about picturesquely in a corduroy waistcoat with brass buttons and a pair of snowy white pyjamas, was meagre, red-haired, and much lined and seamed with exposure. Both wore the Tartar cap of black astrakhan fur, and both talked loudly and quickly. Well, they would have been dressed rather differently to the normal Afghan, whose, I think, dress hasn't changed very much in the last 100 years, in which they would be wearing a long kurta, a long shirt outside.
You know, I'm being hard on Rudyard Kipling, but I have to admit I'm not the least bit immune to the magic of what he writes. But I do notice that again and again, Kipling comes back to writing about some kind of imbalance where the Westerner is there with a lot of money spent on educating that man, typically, and transporting him to South or Central Asia and arming him and equipping him, and then he's brought low by a stone or an arrow.
Yes, this appears in a poem called Arithmetic on the Frontier. A scrimmage in a border station, a canter down some dark defile, £2,000 of education drops to a 10-rupee desile. The crammer's boast, the squadron's pride, shot like a rabbit in a ride. Well, of course, those troops were there not really to try to keep peace between rival Pathan factions, and of course the Afghans are a Pathan people, and they were constantly warring between each other. And it was the extraordinary fact that an ordinary jezail, a very cheap rifle made locally up in the northwest frontier with a very long barrel, which usually had to be held up by a notched stick, was able to kill somebody who had had so much training and education.
£2,000, in other words,
that's
an expensive education, killed by one shot from a cheap rifle in the mountains of Afghanistan.
That's right. Now, of course, it would probably be a Stinger missile and a multi-barreled mortar that would be fired at our troops.
In his Barrack Room Ballads, Kipling described the Afghan fighter in a ballad called The Young British Soldier. It might be the most widely known Western passage about Afghanistan. I'd love for you to read about it.
Yes. It's been used for a number of cartoons at various times, unless horrible than the circumstances we're in now. When you're wounded and left on Afghanistan's plains, and the women come out to cut up what remains, just roll to your rifle and blow out your brains and go to your gourd like a soldier. I mean, it's an incredibly horrible factor, but that did happen because we lost an awful lot of soldiers at Maiwand, in the Afghan wars, and in other combats that we had in that country.
Mm-hmm. Michael Smith, thank you very much
it's
for joining
pleasure.
Us.
Thank you very much for letting me speak to you.
Michael Smith is a lecturer and vice president of the Kipling Society. He joined us from Brighton, England. This afternoon, the Arab television network Al Jazeera broadcast a letter from Taliban leader Mullah Omar addressed to the Muslim world. We present a translation and reading of the letter by WBUR's Al Jazeera analyst Ahmed Ahmed.
Muslim or غير Muslim,
in the name of God, Muslim or non-Muslim, we all know that the world is not stable, and there has been war all over it for as long as we can remember. War will remain, but not because of terrorism.
America, Russia, and Israel.
It's because of countries who support terrorism. America, Israel, Russia, and India. The entire world knows those countries are against the Muslims, and they are killing our innocent people. So all the Muslims want to take their revenge against those countries. And this is not terrorism. We know that those countries have enhanced technological capabilities in their weapons industries. And that Muslims cannot defeat that because we don't have those kind of weapons. فالجهاد هو الوظيفة الواجبة. So should Muslims just wait until they die?
الأمريكان يسمون الجهاد إرهابا.
No.
والمجاهد إرهابيا.
We must all join the jihad. And if some of us die in the war, that's our job.
هؤلاء الظالمين جهادا. وأين المجاهد؟
America is saying that jihad is terrorism, but it's just a way to defend our faith. So if any Muslim agreed with me, go to the gatherings on the streets, no matter that you are a child or an adult or an old man. During the next 72 hours, and nobody can stop you from giving your opinion, because you're free. And if you're not Muslim, but you agree with me, then go with your brothers for the gatherings on the streets. If you are a Muslim and have faith in your heart, then go for the jihad to help your brothers in Islam. God help us all.
That was a letter from Taliban leader Mullah Omar, addressed to the Muslim world, read by WBUR's Al Jazeera analyst Ahmed Ahmed. We're going to take a couple minutes now to talk with our own special coverage news analyst, Jack Beattie, about the events of this week and where they've taken us in the war on terrorism. Jack?
Well, you know, that particular communication, this man, if Donald Rumsfeld had had his way, would be dead. His one of his children was killed by American bombing this week, and Muhammad Umar himself was in the line of fire. And according to reports, a judge advocate, essentially a legal officer in the Pentagon, said, no, we can't kill him now because he's a leader. And they missed the chance. And they had him in a – they knew where he was, and they were ready to bomb, and he slipped away. And apparently Rumsfeld spent some hours smashing the furniture.
I bet he did.
He speaks to us as a very lucky man indeed.
Not everyone's been so lucky in Afghanistan this week. There's this incredible story coming. We've been hearing Kipling and at the same time talking about U.S. technology. The Pashtun tribesman and former Mujahideen who went into Afghanistan, Abdul Haq, to try and get Pashtun support for a government against Taliban, captured while fleeing on horseback while U.S. helicopters tried to protect him by the Taliban and then executed. Here's the old and the new all at once, isn't it, Jack?
Oh, gosh, and that we couldn't protect him is a very, very bad sign to send to other people whom we're saying, we'll protect you. It just doesn't look good at all. And most unfortunate, and apparently a meeting in Peshawar of Afghan potential participants in a new government. That didn't go very well. The old king himself wouldn't even deign to go there or talk to them. Not very encouraging there. Not very encouraging with the Northern Alliance, who really want to take Kabul. Some doubt whether they can, given their strength and their sort of intermittent fighting ability, and their complaints. They're complaining now that we're not bombing the Taliban in front of them enough. But if we do that, of course, there's the more complexity that they'll take Kabul, mm-hmm. and that will alienate the rest of the people of Afghanistan. It is a it's complexity upon complexity here. It's like the caves.
A tough week and doubts, or at least a note of less absolute certainty that everything's on track in the military front. We know it doesn't all happen overnight, but you put that together with what today there was a anthrax in the Supreme Court's mailroom facility now, in the CIA's mailroom facility.
Yes, and the continuance of pre-September 11th behavior among the government bureaucracies, the FBI and the CDC and the Army Fort Detrick Germ Warfare Unit, not cooperating, not sharing information. This may have helped to lead to the death of two postal workers. This is bad stuff.
We get the feeling that things may get worse before they get better. Jack, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
We look forward to talking with you next week. Jack Beattie is our special coverage news analyst and senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You've been listening to special coverage from WBUR Boston.